You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's pod is with Melody Wilding, who is an executive and leadership coach. She is a licensed social worker with a master's degree from Columbia University and a former researcher at Rutgers. She's a professor of human behavior at Hunter College and is a contributor to Harvard Business Review, Forbes, and Business Insider. She has a new book. It's called Managing Up, How to Get What You Need from the People in Charge. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over time, the expectations...
Melody Wilding, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Of all the amazing folks I've worked with at Second City over the years, the person who I would say was and is a master at managing up is Tina Fey. When I was her boss, she knew exactly how to help me help her, and in turn, how that made everyone else get the help they needed to succeed. And if you look at her relationship with like Lorne Michaels at Saturday Night Live, who was a notoriously hard boss to work for, she made that a reciprocal successful partnership. And it's mostly noteworthy, I think, because it's pretty rare, isn't it?
It is, because this is a skill we're never taught. Right? You're just dropped into your career and you are mostly valued because of your technical skills. Yet there is often this shift that comes when you reach usually mid-career, mid-level, where your people skills and your ability to navigate those human dynamics, the psychology, even the politics that are happening around you, that actually becomes more important. But so often that's the unspoken, it's the silent expectations and dynamics that we have to navigate that no one ever really gives us a roadmap for.
So there's so many crappy cultural norms that get tossed into the business world. And one of them that I've always seen is like when people are like, well, you don't want to talk about like all your personal stuff at work or whatever. And it's like, I don't know. My personal stuff is what makes me a person. What I have found that's been very successful for me is when my boss know where my interests are, what books I was reading, what movies I like, what sports teams I follow, and vice versa. And that's how you start to make these connect points, because you're really seeing each other first as a human being and not as a boss and employee.
That's right. And I love that you had the courage to do that, because that's what it takes.
I don't know if it was courage. It might have just been foolishness, but it worked.
But I love that you did that, because the people I see who are most successful, they focus on finding a triple win. They focus on things that are, yes, going to be useful and productive and fulfilling for them, but they also look at what does my boss care about and what's going to be of value for the organization. And so managing up is really about you getting what you need at work. And that does require that we be forthcoming about these are my strengths. This is how you can get the best performance out of me, where I think I can bring the most value. And most managers enjoy that because you're making their life easier. You're basically saying, these are the types of things, please put me in, coach, in these certain areas. And that's a gift to a lot of managers.
So I'm married to, my wife's a comedy professor. She runs the first ever BA in comedy writing and performance. And one of the things that she talks about, the difference between improvisers and stand-ups, is that improvisers do perspective taking, like we get suggestions, right, and then create scenes. But stand-ups do a different thing. They do perspective giving. They have to teach the audience how to watch them. And if you think about your favorite stand-ups, they always start with like what's wrong with them or a problem or something bad that happened to them. Patton Oswalt is a schlub. Amy Schumer is a slut. Like, it goes on and on. You start the book with probably like an embarrassing bad day at work. Can you talk about when you got this phone call?
Yes. And this was something that I hid for many years because I was ashamed of it. Right. And I talk about the first chapter of the book is about what I call the alignment conversation and how I totally screwed this up and was really blindsided by this out of the blue phone call one day where I should have seen it coming. When your boss asks you to get on a call 8 a.m. on a Monday, you should know something's up, right? But my spidey senses didn't go off until I heard somebody else's voice on the line. And all she said is, you know, Melody, I'm on this call to let you know your employment has been terminated immediately. And I could feel the blood rushing out of my face and just your stomach drop in that moment. And as I looked back on it, I shouldn't have been surprised by any of that because I wasn't having the right conversations with my manager. I had high level alignment. I knew what I was working on. I knew why it mattered to her. But what now looking back on it, when I, you know, 2020 is hindsight, I can see how what I was working on was a pet project that only she cared about. And everyone else saw it as a huge money pit. And that is ultimately what came to bite me because when they had to make cuts, I was the first person that was let go. And I didn't have other advocates willing to fight for me. And that's an important part about managing up is that traditionally we're taught to think about it as this is your relationship with your boss, right? That's your key relationship. But today you need to think so much more broadly. It may be other people in the organization. It may be certain behind the scenes people that would have been really helpful if I had a contact in HR who said, oh, we're doing this compensation assessment. Maybe you should be thinking about what types of projects you were on. That would have saved me in that situation. So we need to think about broaden our definition of what it means to manage up.
All right. I want to dig into alignment because it's thorny and there's a lot of different things happening. I've mentioned this on a couple podcasts and I'm going to mention it again because I interviewed Rosalind Chow, who has a book called The Doors You Can Open. And she talks about the differences between sponsorship and mentorship. And she says, mentorship is when people are talking to you. Sponsorship is when they're talking about you. That to me is like, that's part of this, right? Like you mentors are good. Like that's their science behind that. But also you want to know that people are talking about you and that signals value to other people.
100%.
Have you experienced or not experienced that?
Yes, right. It is, you need to be successful. You need to get things done through other people. And now we work in environments where everything is so siloed. Our communication is so siloed, especially if you're someone who's working remotely or in a distributed environment. Your boss may not see what you're doing day to day. How can they possibly advocate for you when they don't know the ins and outs of how you think about situations? You mentioned what you're interested in. And this is where managing up is really, it's a two-way street. Right? We need to assert our own preferences and needs, but we also need to understand and build trust with our managers so that they open up about certain things. And so just a really simple shift you can make is in your one-on-ones, do not focus them on status updates. That's a huge mistake I see people make is they just make it a laundry list rundown of, okay, I contacted the client about this. This other thing is now in progress. And it's just an update that frankly could have been done asynchronously. Your one-on-ones should be starting with milestones, key wins, outcomes, things that are more results oriented so that your manager sees what you're accomplishing, how you're giving them visibility into your thought process or your problem-solving methods, but you're also essentially giving them a cheat sheet that they can run up their own chain of command to say, Kelly was really instrumental in making sure we could get this key hire over the finish line. And that is so valuable. That's what helps you become known through your manager. So that's a really easy switch that a lot of people can make.
The other thing you talk about in this sort of beginning alignment section is the idea of the need to be fully present. Mm-hmm. And this is such an improv thing, right? You can't improvise successfully if you're not listening to everything. And you're listening to the whole person, not just the words they're saying. It's like, what's the mood? What's going on? And then you're adjusting because of that. Again, it's the opposite of checklist. But it's also not something we're taught or that we necessarily practice.
It's really uncomfortable. It's really uncomfortable. I know I tend to work with people that are more emotionally sensitive and attuned to other people's behaviors and shifts. And they'll tell themselves, well, I don't want to pry, right? If they really wanted to tell me, they would just come out and tell me. And you have to realize that sometimes people may not know or have the skills to articulate some of that discomfort for themselves. So as you were saying, you know, even just gently calling out, hey, I'm noticing there's some tension when we're talking about this certain project. Are there other things I should know that's going on above you that would be important for me and my team to be aware of, for example? Or one technique I mention in the book comes from Chris Voss, FBI negotiator, and he talks about this idea of mirroring, that you use the end of a person's sentence to just mirror back a few words or phrases to make them go deeper. So someone may say, like, we have a problem with client acquisition. And you might say, with client acquisition, right? And it's just a gentle way to get at that. Or I like asking, what else? And what else? Mm-hmm. And what else? Not in an annoying way, but just in a gentle sort of opening. You are staying with that person. You're not letting them just get out with one surface level answer.
I was, my wife was in Paris last week. So she teaches a class at Northwestern, called the Agile Pitch. So these are all basically engineering students. They're learning how to pitch. And I did a bunch of question exercises with them because people are pretty reluctant to ask questions. There's taboos around asking questions when in fact, science backs this up completely, that asking questions is the only way you can actually get to someone's truth. And people do want to be seen and heard. So their truth is important to them. So, and you talk about this in the book. It's also the only way you're going to learn the style of a person and understand your style is that sort of question exchange.
Yeah. Yeah. And also that's why we start with the alignment conversation, because many of the later ones in the book require you being more assertive about advocating for what you want. But alignment is so much about listening, observing, leaning into what's happening, asking good questions, and not just what's your priority, right? But going a layer deeper. Why is that the key priority? What are you measuring with your boss or having to report up to them that we need to be aware of? So going a layer deeper, and questions help people feel understood. Right? It builds trust and rapport when you are showing interest in your boss. It starts to shift the power dynamic from one of you being a subordinate and an order taker who's just responding to everything your boss gives you. And it's a huge way to step towards being more of a trusted partner and an advisor to your manager. It actually helps level out some of the power dynamic.
When you talk about flexing in the book, you talk about supercharging communication. Yeah. How so? What do you mean by your term of flexing?
Yes. So this is the second conversation, styles. You were mentioning that yep. If alignment is understanding what we need to work on. Styles is how do we do that successfully, even though we may have totally different personalities? And that's where flexing comes in, which is making sure that our message lands and can be heard by someone that has a totally different approach than us. Classic example is, personally, I am someone who I want to understand all of the background, who's been involved since the beginning, how does everybody feel about the situation? Those are my preferences. And I have had a lot of leaders in my career who don't care at all about any of that. They don't care about people's feelings. They want the bottom line. They just want the high-level bullet points. Yet, when I try to lead with all of that background information, that person gets frustrated. I don't feel seen. I feel frustrated and cut off, and that they're just being a jerk. So flexing is about recognizing that what we perceive as a difficult behavior is often just the result of a difference in approach, and that we can make selective strategic adaptations, not completely overhauling who we are, but if we make small changes to how we present, package, position our message, that it's so much more likely we're going to get through to that person and we'll be able to get the outcome we want. And sometimes it can be as simple as switching the wording that you're using. You were mentioning your wife working with engineers, right? And so wording that may appeal to someone who's an engineer, process, methodology, precision, right? But if we're talking with someone who is a visionary, pie in the sky founder, then we want words like vision, mission, big picture, motivation. And even just switching out that language, it's going to make a huge difference in how that is received.
It's interesting. We had Scott Barry Kaufman on the podcast, and he talks a lot about cognitive flexibility and this idea. And he is applying it in the world of what he calls competitive victimhood. We live in a world right now where everyone's playing the victim. We live in a world where people are actively trying to not understand each other. And all of these things go against the grain of what it means to be part of a successful human endeavor. And so it's true. It's society-wide, but you know, it manifests itself inside things like your home and at work. And I think to ignore the things that we know from psychology, from science, from anthropology, all this stuff is ridiculous, because it's those things help us have these little communities of people. Because we all know working with other humans is not easy. It's I knew this from my very first job. I don't know about you, but I was the Jewel food store. I walked in. I was there for about 2 days where I'm like, this is barely contained chaos, you know, and it worked. It was a grocery store, but it was like, it was clear to me. And I'm like, okay, so this is how are we going to deal with that? But it is not the norm, seemingly, to have these kinds of conversations or even to give people this kind of training.
Yes. Yeah. And that's why we almost need a roadmap for how do you build this skill? Because so many of us, when we get feedback on our performance review that you need to be better at influencing without authority, we get little one-liners. We're told be proactive or come with solutions, not problems. But it's so much deeper than that. It is understanding how do humans work, what raises our defensiveness, right? How do we come around and get buy-in for ideas or advocate for ourselves in a way that doesn't piss people off or step on toes? And the idea of flexing, you talked about cognitive flexibility. And what I have found in my work over and over again is that is one of the biggest signs of professional maturity, is being able to respond to the situation. And again, make conscious, intentional adaptations instead of just sticking to one rigid style. It's huge, especially now when you have to work across so many different locations and cultures and people. You have to have that not only awareness, but also the agility.
Yeah, another aspect that's related is reframing. So that people who are great at reframing, I find like you need that on your team, because it's like you're looking at a problem a certain way. It's like if you frame it differently, maybe it's not a problem.
Yes.
And I want to say this too, because you mentioned bring me your solutions, not your problems. Hate that. The other thing I hate is I had a boss who kept saying, stay in your lane.
Interesting. Can I ask why?
They were trying to coalesce power, and they didn't like it when other people brought suggestions. I didn't want the creatives talking to the marketing people. Would be like, the marketing people are never going to talk to the creatives. I'm like, actually, we all talk to each other. It's funny because a boss who came in over both of us heard this, and at a very early stage meeting, he said, I've been hearing a lot about stay in your lane. He put up a slide, which was a pool with the swimmers in the lanes. And then he put up another slide, and it was just a big pool with no lanes. He's like, we're all in this pool together. Mm-hmm. And I was so happy, because I was like, oh, you, like, I didn't even talk to him about it, but he saw it. And it was like, look, and I think boundaries are important. You talk about that in the book, and you should have those kinds of conversations. But that not to the exclusion that we stop listening to each other's input, not to the exclusion that we're not going to listen when someone maybe with a different point of view sees something we don't see.
Mm, I totally agree. Totally agree. And I think all of that leads back to the idea that we're going to have to work with people that have insecurities and project those insecurities onto us. And it's not always realistic to get up and leave your job tomorrow. You have to learn how to work with imperfect people and imperfect situations. And in that case, being able to have, in the book, I talk about the networking conversation that you need. Do not make your boss your single point of failure, because you need those other outlets for information. You need to build your social capital with other people, because if, thank goodness, that other leader came in and said, this is not working, we're not doing this anymore. But if it hadn't, maybe you could have built a coalition with other people and gone to that manager and said, hey, these are the consequences of this approach. This is the cost of us staying in our lane, quote unquote. Are we willing to continue bearing this, or do we want to make some changes? Here's what we would suggest, right?
All right, you talked about networking. You've worked with young people. They don't like to network. I don't know if you've noticed.
I have. As a elder millennial, I feel that deeply, as someone who came up in the final days of the mixer world, the awkward mixers, and who doesn't like to pick up a phone. I completely get it. But you do it to your own detriment. And even if you are someone who is introverted, I'm very introverted, but there are still ways to build recognition and relationships that don't involve putting yourself out there at a sleazy networking event. And so much of them is increasing your surface area, your opportunities for serendipity. And I think that's where people really hurt themselves now, is that we're all in our houses, or we're all in our little cubicles, or just in our team, and we don't really go outside of that. And this doesn't have to be, you know, you're spamming everyone you work with on LinkedIn to meet with you. This could be as simple as you join an employee resource group, because that's going to allow you to cross-pollinate with people of different levels, and you have a built-in interest around a certain identity or skill that you have. It could be that you go to the company volunteering event on the weekend, or that if leaders do have office hours, many companies have this where higher level leaders just have open time where you can grab time on their calendar, that you take advantage of that. And you use that not to, you know, just toot your own horn, but to ask them questions about what are they seeing at their level, and what's keeping them up at night, and what trends are coming down the pike for them that they're watching. All of those little interactions can go such a long way. And my pro tip here is, whenever you do meet with someone, actually two things. Make an information-based ask. In the book, I call this an info ask. And that's where, just like it sounds, you're asking for information. You're not asking for a career sponsorship or mentoring. You're asking for something like, could you give me insight into how this process works? Or do you have a recommendation for someone I could talk to who's worked with this client before, or a vendor? It's information-based. It's lower stakes. It makes the person feel like, ooh, this person wants my expertise. And it gives you a built-in reason to follow up. That's one thing. And then second is that whenever you do meet with someone casually, like you have a coffee chat or a lunch with a coworker, always ask, who else should I know? Who else should I be meeting with? So that you're organically expanding that without having to do much high lift work yourself.
So this is hugely important. And we should double click on the fact that you have to be very intentional about this. Yeah. So you start making lists. People should make a list of all the different, join a board, take an improv class, you know, like do that. So people reach out to me on LinkedIn all the time, and I will tell you the difference between the people I agree to do an informational interview and not is the person who is like, I'm specific about what they've seen in my work. They're like, I listened to your podcast, or I read your book, or I saw this. Could I have 15 minutes just to talk? I always say yes to that. And the people who I don't, who are like, hey, I think we could benefit from a conversation, and there's no photo of them on their LinkedIn profile or whatever. I mean, you know, it's like if you are using details, showing me that you actually understand who you're reaching out to, I'll take the call. And I do that a lot. Like I probably once a week I'll have some sort of informational interview. But you know, I did it too. Like when I was younger in my career, I always set up situations where I was like, well, what, you know, I'm going to go to this luncheon. I don't want to go to the luncheon. The food's not going to be good. But you never know who I'm going to be sat next to. I'll tell you this. I went to a luncheon. This is actually recently, but I shouldn't necessarily want to go. But I got sat next to the executive director of the University of Chicago Crime Lab. And last week, I co-taught my second session where we were teaching senior law enforcement improv as a skill for their communications skills in policing.
Wow.
And it's been an incredible, and the AP was there. They're going to write an article on it. And this is would not have happened if I didn't say yes to a lunch.
Yep. Yeah, it's so true. It's so true. And there have been, I met my husband at one of those terrible networking events where.
Seriously?
Yeah, I certainly did. And yeah, I can remember I did not want to go. And I just had that mindset of, you know what? There's that phrase, don't focus on making the right decision. Focus on making the decision right. Commit to the decision and then figure out how do I get the most out of this? Right. And so I didn't go there saying I'm looking for a husband, but I said
that would have been weird at a work event. Yeah.
I think there are plenty of people that do that, but that was not my mindset at that time. But I did go there and say, I'm open to whatever happens. And I'm open to just having conversations with people and seeing where it goes. But what I love about, and I'm so glad to hear you do those informational meetings. Thank you for being one of those people for others. What I hear in that too is, those people also maybe use a little bit of social proof. Maybe sometimes someone will say, oh, so-and-so mentioned that I should listen to your podcast, or you had this person on your show whose book I love. And that goes a really long way because when we're thinking about influence, right, we may not always have that credibility built up with that person directly, but we can draft on the credibility of others. And so at work, maybe you're talking to a VP about something, you're trying to convince them on a certain decision. And you can tastefully name drop and say, well, I've talked with Susan in finance already about this. And you know, the VP trusts Susan, right? And that instantly shortcuts some of the defensiveness and helps you get to the buy-in faster.
You also talk about feedback in the book. Are you good at giving and or receiving feedback?
Probably neither.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I certainly wasn't at the beginning of my career. I'm much better now, but I flubbed it. Here's what's interesting. And I've talked about this probably not recently. I flubbed it when I was dealing with my staff. I was really good at it when dealing with the artists. Somehow when I was with the artists, I always knew, well, they're artists, so I have to go in and give them specific information that they can use. I can't give bullshit notes. I also have to appreciate the things that they are good at. Mm-hmm. And it's not like a SHIT sandwich. You know, it's more of like, look, like you're very good at this. I think you could do that more. And that's the other thing I think you talk about this in the book, of let people do the things they're good at a lot rather than have them do a bunch of things that they're not very good at.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And what the framework you were using is one I recommend all of the time because it's solution focused and it's positive, which sometimes it's called plus delta, this idea of what's already going well, what could be even better, right? It disarms someone while also giving them constructive direction. And so that's a great one. Again, even if the power dynamics are turned around, boss, here's what's already working. Could we do more of this? Mm-hmm. And could we do more of this could be something completely new that you want to introduce into your relationship. But as you were asking me that question, I reflect on it a little bit. I think over the years, I've become better at receiving feedback just because I have more people giving it to me, readers and people, random people on the internet. I've definitely grown, I don't want to say a thicker skin, but I've definitely come around. I was one of those people that any bit of feedback was, I would be in tears, right? Because my identity was hurt. I love to hear you say that it was actually easier to give it to the artist because I wouldn't have thought that because art can be so subjective and taste oriented. And so it sounds like you were able to, I'm just curious, how did you overcome?
Well, yeah. If you think about it, that like we should be treating everyone like they're artists is my point. So I have such respect for, I mean, I'm giving notes to Stephen Colbert. Okay. Now he's not famous, but he's brilliant, and I know it, and I can see it. And he's a friend too, so it's a little bit different. But Amy Poehler, I'm giving that like we were friendly, we weren't friends, but it's Amy Poehler. I mean, she was good like that the whole time, and so I'm like, okay, this person's very good. I have insights from the outside that can be helpful because I've been at this stuff for a while. And maybe some of it won't be helpful. So I'm going to make sure I've got this amount of time to deliver this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And being honest, but it was this idea, and Del Close, who's one of the gurus of our work, talks about treating everyone as poets and artists, you know, that when you do that, you're creating a space where then people can see themselves mm-hmm. as poets and artists. And I think when it just came to staff, I didn't recognize, oh, I need to take from, and this is the point of my book in this podcast, is all the stuff that makes the art great is what makes life great. Mm-hmm. And work is just a part of life. So we artificially build these doors of like, well, I have to change who I am because I'm walking in here. And that doesn't mean you're coming in your pajamas. Don't come in your pajamas unless it's pajama day. But it does mean you use it all. You know, mm-hmm. you listen like your life depends on it with people, and you know, in improv, your job is to save the person across from you. Their job is to save you. And that's the understanding. Make that the understanding in your office. That's sort of what I was thinking.
Yes. Okay. So much good stuff there. Can I ask one more question about the feedback? Did you ever find, or did you like it when people say, Kelly, can you give me feedback specifically on this area, when they almost constrained their feedback?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a gift to both of you.
Yeah.
It's like the other thing you learn here is, so we have a director and a cast. I'm rarely giving feedback to the actors unless it's like a review. Mm-hmm. So what I'm usually talking to the director. When I talk to the director before we even start the feedback, I go, what do you want me to ignore on this list? That scene that's in the second act that doesn't work. I know it doesn't work. Don't worry about it. So what are the three? Because here's the other thing, right? Talk about cognitive overload. You're lucky if three of those notes are going to go anywhere. So really focus in on what can be useful to this human in this moment. And 10 notes is too many notes.
Yes. Yes. So that was my hunch, and also a great tip for managing up, or even managing across, right? If we're talking about a peer relationship here, let someone know, because I see this with the creatives I work with, is that they will go to someone in leadership and say, what do you think of this design? And they're getting notes on things they thought were already decided, right? Or things they know aren't working. And so if you can be more specific that at this point, we're not worrying about the color scheme. At this point, we're concerned about the messaging and the positioning of this. That's the reason why the book is called Get What You Need from the People in Charge, because you're shaping the dynamic, right? You're guiding what you need out of that interaction. And you mentioned the idea of cognitive overload. Huge. Recognizing that all of us are overstimulated all of the time. We have way too much information. So a few key takeaways from that is, successfully managing up most of the time comes down to saving your manager cognitive energy. Whether that's in terms of, hey, if you have feedback for me, this would be, I would really appreciate it if when you share that, it could be, you share these three things with it. Or if you need them to advocate for something in a meeting, you give them a sample slide or a list of FAQs that may come up, a template email to reach out to someone on your behalf. Make it easier for them to do their job. They will love you. And again, then you're shaping what's happening.
The other aspect, and you do talk about this, of communication is storytelling. So when we did our first session with the University of Chicago Crime Lab folks, one of my co-facilitators, Tyler Dean Kemp, realized he was about to talk about storytelling. And he's like, I taught this in college, at Columbia College. I taught storytelling. So I'm going to actually just take you through a quick thing. And he kind of used Star Wars as an example, but just sort of pointing out the arc of a story, beginning, middle, end. There's got to be a transformation, all this stuff. And I could see the eyes widen, because no one had ever talked to these cops about how to tell stories. And they are telling stories every single day, and stories are being told to them every single day. And it was, we realized the second time around that we'd be very intentional in how we used it and had them do some storytelling exercises, because your ability to, we have an exercise called 60-30-10, where you tell a story in 60 seconds, 30 seconds, and 10 seconds, and then sometimes a hashtag. And it allows you to realize there are so many different ways that you will need to tell a specific story. And sometimes it's going to be time-based, especially in a crisis communication, like in law enforcement. I don't think I was ever taught that at any level of my schooling ever. I learned it at Second City. You know, you learn it like in theater classes, like, but man, oh man, that's maybe one of the things that's been most powerful for me in my career.
I love that. I love that. Yes. And the stories are how we remember information. And we were talking about cognitive overload, right? You need to make it easy for people to retain what you're telling them. So don't tell them too much. And actually what I have found is most of us are trained to tell stories a way that totally works against our psychology. We have the 5-paragraph essay model of start with your argument and the background and then build up to your hypothesis and your conclusion. When in this world, because you only have a short amount of time, you have to get to your conclusion or your recommendation right away and then fill in the gaps. Or in the arts, right, we often start at the height of the action and then we fill in the details about that character's background and how they got here. I think storytelling for a lot of people is very intimidating because we think of Disney and Pixar and Star Wars, and we're like, well, I'm not that kind of storyteller. So those simple frameworks go a long way. And in the book, I share a few. Very simple one is problem, action, solution. What was the situation that you were facing? What was the issue? And then what was the action you or your team took? What was the outcome? That's it. Very simple, but easy for you to remember if you have to tell something on the spot. So you can organize your thinking very quickly, right? You can make it succinct and crisp for someone else if you're speaking up in a meeting and trying to relate a quick anecdote about something. So that's a very simple one that people can steal.
All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for your yes and story. But before we do that, you, at the end of the book, chapter 10, which is called The Quitting Conversation, you say, quote, how you exit a role is often just as important as how you perform in it, end quote. I don't think people think about their exits. I think that that is pure emotion, and it's either like giving the bird, walking out, or it's like, but I don't think people understand that you're leaving a wake, and that wake is hitting a bunch of other people who exist in the same world you live in, mm-hmm. probably in the same field.
Yes. And that's exactly why I included that yeah. line. And there is something in psychology called the peak end effect, mm-hmm. which is our perception literally peaks of someone at the end. It's the recency effect. It's a bias that we have. And you are really shooting yourself in the foot if you let emotions take hold in that moment. Trust me, I have had when I was let go from that one job, you better believe I was very emotional about it. And I wanted to say all sorts of things, but I didn't, because I know some people from that company have become clients now, and everything mm-hmm. comes back full circle. And especially today, I'm sure you have seen that you encounter someone in a different role. Maybe they're a director or an administrator of somewhere that you're working. And so people will also talk, and you want to make sure that the narrative being told about you is one to a certain extent you are satisfied with. And you mentioned the wake. And so we want to think about, how am I leaving people in the best situation possible? Whether that is a transition plan, it's making sure that we're a part of the communications that are being told. Like if there are external clients or vendors that need to be notified, you better make sure that with your manager and HR, you are working on how your announcement, your leaving, is rolled out and what is being said about that and what happens next. All of that is so crucial for your relationships now, but you never know what's going to happen later.
All right. We always end the podcast with a yes and story. You have one for us?
I do. I have so many. And I think...
Oh, I love that.
Yes. Well, one of them was meeting my husband at that event, mm-hmm. was saying yes and... I'm going to go to this event and I'm going to make the most of it. So that was one of them. And I think really writing this book was another yes and, because when I had the idea, when it was sort of serendipity that I had an idea along these lines and a publisher approached me and said, we think you would be great to write a book on this topic. All of my fraudy feelings came up and I said, no, sure. I can't do this. But I said, yes, and I will figure it out. And so what I've learned is I can't wait until I feel 100% ready to do something, because I will never feel 100% ready. I'll always keep pushing that goalpost down. I have to act. And then I gain the confidence as I go.
Yeah, that's how that works. The book is called Managing Up, How to Get What You Need from the People in Charge. Melody Wilding, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Getting to Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.